This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
So good to see people I haven't seen for a long time. And Kay and I are really delighted to be with you all. I got a call from Rebecca this summer to see what I might want to do. And I just came up with this topic just sort of out of the top of my head. So we'll see how it works. I've been reading over the years about the philosophers in the first century, about the time that Paul was doing his ministry. And it turns out that the Apostle Paul used many of the same sort of principles and ideas that are used in, by the Hellenistic moralists at the same time. So I thought I could just talk generally about some of that. And then you're getting a handout from 1 Thessalonians that has some stuff underlined. Just sort of ignore that for now, and we can talk about why that sort of shows some of the same principles. The first thing I think we ought to do is just talk about what's the point of philosophy in the first place. Philosophy now, and I can testify to this because I did that degree in the philosophy department at UT, is largely about analytical philosophy. It's about looking at what language means. It's about sort of parsing it, meaning in very fine units. And it's not really so much anymore about how to live a good life, but that was very different than philosophy in the first century. It was mostly about how to pursue human happiness, what it means to be happy, what are the conditions for human flourishing. So that's the kind of philosophy that has a real tie to religion. And so we might think for a moment about what are the conditions on which we all live, because the human condition is really not much different now than it was at the time of Paul. When things are going well in our lives, we don't think much about what's happening. We're just sort of coasting along, enjoying the flow. But that doesn't usually work for very long for any of us. We have certain sources of disruption and suffering in all our lives. One that we all deal with is bad health, things that happened to us that we didn't experience as young people, or something that drops out of us out of the blue. We have to deal with aging, with change. We deal with all sorts of conditions that society places upon us that may not agree with our own values. False values of society. That's one of the things the first century philosophers talked about a lot. They also talked about the effect of the passions on people. You know, largely, I'll talk about the different philosophical schools in a minute, but one of the things that they're all dealing with is the effect of the passions on the human soul. They didn't have a very sophisticated medical model in those days, but sometimes, at least the Stoics thought the soul was something that was sort of like an organ inside your body, and it could be disturbed by the passions. You get angry, you have just different kinds of disruption of your soul. It's like waves that are happening on the pond, and all of a sudden you're not calm and you know, level anymore. You're disrupted and you do crazy things. So the passions were related to a lot of things that afflicted people. Also, the idea of correct views about what was happening in the universe had to do with human happiness. So they wanted to redefine what really was of value in the world that was different than maybe what society was telling us. So generally, all of us are in a position where we need to be saved. We need to be saved delivered from bad health, from unhappiness in different kinds of ways. And the word for salvation, soteria, has to do with healing. It has to do with all sorts of changing your views in order to live in a life of harmony, of virtue, and of inner peace. And what you do in order to find salvation is generally, and then, as it now, you find a teacher who can lead you into a better way of living. There's the means of deliverance is the teacher who corrects your views of what's happening in life, frees you from your passions, leads you not to worry about things that are beyond one's control. So that was one element particularly of Stoicism. There are lots of things that you can, that you're faced with in life that you really can't change. And so the goal is to find some way to be achieve inner calm in spite of all that. Finally, there are different ways of being happy that have to do with patterns of life, the virtues, the vices. The vices lead you into inner disruption and affliction of your soul. The virtues are things we practice in order to have good character that tends to bring people to happiness and generally the term is eudaimonia, it's sort of human flourishing. Well, the point of conversion is at the point at which we all realize that we've got to change. Whatever we're doing, however we were looking at the world, is somehow just not working anymore. So does that make any sense that we all, I don't know if we all feel like this. I know William James had the view in his Varieties of Religious Experience that there were two different kinds of people in the world. There were the sort of happy-go-lucky people who get through life just sort of without really dealing with any kind of inner conflict. And then there are the sort of dark souls who are inclined to sort of suffering and religious experience. And I've got a feeling a lot of us, if we're in church, must be that second variety because we have some sense that we need to find a better way of life, find a way to live that frees us from some of the confusion in our lives. We need to find a life of moderation, of self-control, of sometimes a rejection of society's values. Dean of Grace Cathedral once said that the three things that society is trying to teach us is that we should care about appearance, affluence, and achievement. He thought that one of the ways to lead people to healthy living was to get free of that idea that any of those three things really mattered in terms of the human soul. Finally, all of these philosophers, in spite of the fact that we don't think of them necessarily as religious, had the view that reverence was an important quality. It was a virtue that led people to kind of respect for the gods and for other people. And so you can't live a life without reverence that's a life of balance and health. And so you have a need to find a new way of talking about what's happening in the universe. So at the point of conversion, the teacher comes along, or the philosopher or somebody like Paul, and they tell you a different way of looking at the world. Paul is very succinct in a lot of ways in how he describes what happened. There's a sort of formula that we come down to us about Christ has died, Christ has risen, Christ will come again. It's shorthand for the big story of the universe. Or if you look at through the speeches in Acts about, there probably weren't real speeches by Peter or Paul, but their attempt to kind of find the kernel of what happened through Jesus' teaching, why it's able to change our lives. It could have been Paul, it could have been Peter, it could have been a cynic philosopher on the street corner that points out to people the madness of society's values and the need to change. Somebody at St. David's years ago got me to read a novel by Tom Wolfe called A Man in Full. Has anybody read A Man in Full? Yep, good. All right, what'd you think? I thought it was a great book. It was about a real estate developer named Charlie Corker. And he was a kind of classic success story in terms of affluence, appearance, and achievement. But he reached a crisis in his life where everything was falling apart. He was basically going bankrupt. I can't remember all the things that were afflicting him, but it all just sort of tumbled down. In the midst of all this, he found a man who had been reading Epictetus, who was a Stoic philosopher in the first century. And so Charlie Corker, in the midst of all this crisis, found his life completely transformed by the reading of this ancient philosopher. Well, that's probably A modern version of what could have happened in the ancient world is someone encountered a cynic on the street corner, or a Stoic philosopher, or the Apostle Paul, or somebody like that, who led them into a different way of looking at the world, a different way of looking at the society's values, or of looking at what really was centrally important in life. Well, there was probably, we know in Christianity, and it was true in the different philosophical schools as well, there was a period after conversion when the newly converted person had to be worked on and encouraged, because the only thing I can think of that was like this is when I went to Weight Watchers. It was, and when I retired from St. David's, I was really Charlie Corcoran. I was feeling like my life was falling apart, and I knew for sure the one thing that I needed to do was lose 20 pounds. So I went to Weight Watchers. It was all these ladies and me. And it was very much like a philosophical school. They talked about what was important. It was all about self-control and encouraging one another. And, you know, it was, you got little stars to wear and stuff if you did a good job. But I lost my 20 pounds. And I've got a feeling that these different philosophical schools had something like that to nurture people in this early part of their conversion. We know that in Christianity, there was something called the catechumenate, which where you came into Christianity, you learned this sort of formal stuff about what the story was. But a lot of it was just encouraging people, being around other people who believed the same things. And when you backslid in some way, they would prop you up and keep you going until at some point you're ready for full initiation into the new life. So at that point, probably on Easter Vigil, you would take the new catechumens, have them baptized, they died to the old life, rose to the new, and from that point on, they were full members of the group. So I don't think the philosophical schools did anything quite that dramatic, but they definitely had this period of encouragement of new converts. And it was a very healthy thing to do. Then people, we know that people have to be continually encouraged and strengthened to do and to keep the faith and to live in the matter consistent with their views. Well, this could involve living in a commune. If you were an Epicurean, the idea was to completely withdraw from the world, to live in something. Epicurus lived in something he called the garden, where he surrounded himself with just a few friends who shared his values. And the idea was they just kept apart from society completely. They didn't want to be infected with the inadequate views of the world. But Christians weren't like that. Christians got together in little groups, but they also were out in the world working and doing things. So they had to find a way to live in the world but not of the world. And a lot of what Paul is doing is instructing people on how to do that sort of thing. We know that we're shaped by our surroundings and friends. So the early followers of Jesus would have to be shored up against the seductions of the world and against living the general human tendencies to take it easy and not do the work necessary to live carefully and in full awareness of what they have professed. That was back to Weight Watchers. You go in and you kind of give your confession of how you did for the week, you know. And people would either, you know, be glad that you lost a pound, or they would console you for your failings, you know, to be powerless in the form of face of a cupcake. I think I might need to go back because I gained back 10 of my 20 pounds, so I'm powerless in the face of gelato, I think. But anyway, this brings us to Paul and what we learned in his letters to communities that are in this stage of religious development. So Paul, in writing letters to people, was dealing with people who were already past the conversion phase. They were already people on the path in the line, but they were people who nevertheless needed to be encouraged. So the letters were parenetic in nature. They were about shoring people up, encouraging them, giving them direction and subtle advice on how to live this new life. They know the basic teachings. They know the basic way of life they need to follow, but they need to be encouraged, and they need to be at time corrected when they go off of course. And so Paul's role is complicated. Paul is kind of like clergy, because we have this problem where we're supposed to be teachers, and yet we're also employees at the same time. Paul was somebody who, to some extent, got financial support from different communities, but he also worked on his own, too, and we'll hear about that in a bit. But he was the patron. In a sense, he was the patron of all these people he led into baptism. So he was like their spiritual father, and yet he needed patronage from them to keep the ministry going. So it's this kind of delicate balance between how much advice can you give to people who are sending you money to send to Jerusalem? That's the question. Paul is thus in the role of this philosopher. He is the term that they use for this. He's a psychagogue. He's in charge of the care of the soul of all these people. And that's the role he assumes when he's writing to all these congregations. He is the person who leads these communities in just the way a philosopher would if he were confronting people in person. And thus we see many parallels to the methodology of Hellenistic philosophers and the tools which they use in dealing with the care, encouragement, and instruction of their followers. Well, even the early church recognized that Hellenistic philosophy was something they needed to respect. Justin Martyr said that whatever has been correctly said by all men belongs to Christians. In other words, if anybody else got it right, we're going to claim credit for it. I think that's a very healthy view, really. Certain philosophers seem particularly appropriate to the Christian message, particularly the Stoics, because Christians are always talking about, self-control. And it's a good thing. Stoicism is really fundamentally our religious way of life in Christianity. But there are other people, too. Of the Stoics, Musonius Rufus, Epictetus, Dio Chrysostom, Seneca, Plutarch was not a Stoic, Marcus Aurelius, and Cicero were all read widely by early Christians. Then there were the Cynic philosophers. Cynics were people who were deeply critical of conventional views. To some extent, the Cynics had an influence on how Paul operated, and we'll talk about that. Then there's even a tie with the Epicureans. Everybody was critical of the Epicureans. They were the sort of crazy hippies of the day. And so almost all the different philosophical schools had something to say about why the Epicureans were wrong. However, the Christians, in a way, in withdrawing partly from the world, were very much like the Epicureans. And they also, in the Christian emphasis on friendship, for the Epicureans, friendship was the highest goal of human life. So Christian friendship is very much similar to that. And actually, what we're all about is friendship with one another and friendship with God. So if you took away that from Christianity, we might as well all go home. So it's definitely similar to Epicurean's view of that, of friendship. Well, Paul is using letters for encouragement, which was not unknown in the ancient world either. They were trying to encourage people they weren't with about the principles of life that the people already knew. That's what encouragement is like. You're not trying to teach anybody anything. You're trying to keep them going in the path. Seneca said, we obviously know facts without paying attention to them. I realize that. I get up and I eat the cookie, you know. I know I shouldn't eat the cookie, but if somebody had been there writing a letter to me at the time, I might have been encouraged not to do it. Seneca says, advice is not teaching. It merely engages the attention and arouses us and concentrates the memory and keeps it from losing its grip. So you have to keep reminding yourself that to do the right thing. Dio Chrysostom said, since I observe that it is not our ignorance of the differences between good and evil that hurts us, so much as it is the failure to heed the dictates of reason on these matters. In other words, we know what we should do. We have reason, but we just don't do it anyway. So he said, I consider that it is most salutary to remind men of this without ceasing. We never can stop talking about what's good and what's bad. It's just encouraging us to do what we need to do. And he says, to appeal to their reason to give heed in their acts and observe what is right, good, and proper. So I had a really transforming moment here, right here at St. David's, up in the sanctuary one day. I was, we did a lot of listening to one another's sermons. And I have to admit, after you heard the sermon once, the second service, I wasn't really paying much attention. But I was inside the altar rail with the acolytes, and I kind of dozed away. The acolyte turned to me and said, I don't get that sermon at all. What was that about? And I thought back to the first service, and I said, well, I think it was about goodness is better than badness. And when you think about it, I would say a good 60% of our sermons are about goodness is better than badness. And, you know, you think that's kind of stupid, and it is, sort of. But what the clergy are trying to do is think over and over of innovative ways to say the same thing, to encourage people to keep doing the things they already know they should do. So that's really what Paul's doing. He's saying, okay, people, goodness is better than badness. And they'll write another letter and say, don't do badness, do goodness. And it really, it's a very useful thing to do. The life of reason, measure, reverence, and so, is so much better than slavery to the passions. That's what they're saying in a more sophisticated way. Then there's a connection between encouragement and imitation. This is really sort of striking in Paul. The first time I read Paul in which he said, imitate me, I was going, that's the most egotistical thing I've ever heard in my whole life. And it really is. Paul definitely had a healthy ego, but he was doing what the philosophers were doing, who all were using themselves as models for their disciples to, for their followers to see what the life was supposed to be like. There was a couple of people in the last 50 years or so who wrote really well about Hellenistic moralism. One was Abe Mallerby, who was a professor at Yale. Then there was Wayne Meeks, who was really good too. But Abe Mallerby said, to be a true follower, one must imitate his model. The morals, therefore, reminds his hearers of outstanding figures, taking care to describe the qualities of virtuous men. So sometimes they would point out historical figures, sages, kings, who were great models to imitate. People loved, the one they really liked was Socrates. People would always hold up Socrates as the ideal to imitate. Paul was using the same sort of form, except he was using himself as the model. So Mallerby quotes another writer named Libanius from the period. It says, when we exhort someone, advising him to pursue something or to abstain for something, this is what Paul is doing. And the emulation of virtuous men stated in antithesis to following bad men belongs to what we've seen in this encouragement literature. So they'd have a list of villains to keep away from and a list of good people to be like. Seneca, in his letter to his young friend Lucilius, talks about models. He says, "Let us choose men who teach by their lives, men who tell us what we ought to do, and then prove it by their practice, who show us what to avoid, and then are never caught doing what they have ordered us to avoid." That's the big one. You can't be a hypocrite, because once you get caught, that's all anyone will ever remember about what you preached. You know, so it's really, really a high bar, and you can see by all the scandals in the church that, boy, you better live the life you're preaching, or their people are going to just be totally dissatisfied. Seneca used his own life as an example. He said, "The way is long if one follows precepts." In other words, if you tell people a bunch of rules, that's the hard way to get people to be good. He said, "But it's short and helpful if one follows examples." Pliny concludes a letter to someone saying, "I mention this not only to enforce my advice by example," he's saying what I'm doing, "but also that this letter may be a sort of pledge binding me to persevere in the same abstinence in the future." He's saying, "I told you not to do this, and now that I've written it down, I better not do it myself either." So it's kind of interesting, because once you you take on a life of giving people advice, it really binds you to a kind of a level of behavior that's very hard to keep. Now I'll have a hard time eating a cookie in front of anyone. I'll have to, you know, sneak out behind the store and eat it in secret. Seneca again says, "The path to which I'm leading you is not different from that on which your nature leads you." In other words, you're inclined to be good people. You know how to be good people. "You were born to such conduct as I describe." And Pliny, in the same way, says, "The love I bear you obliges me to give you not indeed a precept, but a reminder." He's telling him, "You know the rules. I just am trying to get you to be reminded to do it." So we've said that Paul is calling on people to imitate him. Paul is setting himself up as a wise man for imitation. And once you do that, you need to worry about the standards by which these moral teachers are operating. There were a lot of charlatans who were popular philosophers. They talked about that a lot in the literature, how to tell a fake philosopher from a real one. And there was a Dio Chrysostom writes about the four types of philosophers. One, a useless type, is those who just talk in lecture halls and have no concern with changing the lives of people. They were sort of the academics of the day whose teachings didn't have anything to do with helping people lead better lives. Then the second type he didn't like were the cynics who played to the crowds, the flatterers interested only in glory and in money, because if you were a popular philosopher, you could get a bunch of followers behind you, tell them how wonderful they were, ask for donations, and leave town. And that was a, if you look at our, I don't know, I guess I shouldn't go off wild on this, but there are a lot of parallels in the modern world about sort of gurus who on TV or in different ways to get a following and kind of suck people dry, tell them a bunch of stuff, and keep going. You can think of plenty of people like that. I don't need to name names. Then there were the people, the philosophers he didn't like, who were rhetoricians who were specialized in fancy speeches. He didn't think, you know, beautiful speech for its own sake was of any use. It had to change people's lives. Then the fourth kind of philosopher he didn't like was philosophers who used harsh criticism just to shock his hearers without improving them. There were cynics, particularly, who would come into town and tell everybody how stupid they were and then leave town. You know, and so everybody was just sort of going, oh, no, I'm just stupid. I don't know anything. But they didn't change their lives. So that was a useless kind of philosopher. But the ideal here, it says, find a man who with purity and without guile speaks with a philosopher's boldness, not for the sake of glory, nor for making false pretensions for the sake of gain, who stands ready out of goodwill and concern for his fellow man. Goodwill and concern for fellow man is philanthropeia. That's what that is. If need be, to submit to ridicule and uproar of the mob. In other words, if you're a true philosopher, you're going to get in trouble. Get ready to be unpopular. And then he says, in my own case, I know that I've chosen that role. So he's taken on this high ground of moral philosophy. Well, in that way, we can look at some of Paul's letters to see. He has times when he goes, look at all the sufferings I've gone through. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to say, you can tell I'm a true philosopher because I've gone through all this stuff to keep the path. By detailing the wise man's hardships, the moral philosophers established him as a reliable guide for people in their moral development. So you've got to be willing to take the heat in order to be a true philosopher. This is some of what Paul says. This is in 2 Corinthians. We are afflicted in every way. Whenever Paul, for some reason, talks about himself in the royal we. It's always we. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may be made visible in our bodies. And then later in the same letter, he says, as servants of God, we have commended ourselves in every way through great endurances, in afflictions, hardships, calamities, beatings, imprisonment, hunger, by purity, knowledge, patience, kindness, holiness of spirit, genuine love, truthful speech, and the power of God, with the weapons of righteousness for the right hand and for the left, in honor and dishonor, in ill repute and good repute, we are treated as impostors and yet true, as unknown and yet well known, as dying and see we are alive, as punished and yet not killed, as sorrowful and yet rejoicing, as poor yet making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing everything. Paul is very much a philosopher of his day in expressing these sentiments. His hardships distinguish him from people who have only pretended to be a philosopher. So his list of hardships takes us to the center of Paul's understanding of God and his own self-understanding, yet they anchor him in the culture and the conventions of his time. That's what my friend John Fitzgerald said about Paul. He was very much a moralist of his day. And in this term, he was a psychagogue. He cared for people's souls. And in that line, the different philosophical schools had spiritual exercises, psychotherapy, and psychological and pastoral counseling to help people along the way. We all do that stuff still. All of these things are very modern in a way. These principles became models used by people like Seneca, Epictetus, Dio Chrysostom, Plutarch. Conversion to philosophy required a radical reorientation, and entailing social, intellectual, and moral transformation or readjustment, which often resulted in confusion, bewilderment, and sometimes depression. As a Christian, have you ever been confused, bewildered, and depressed? I sure have. And I think that's part of the path. That's why we need one another. You know, one of Paul things Paul does is he says, imitate me, and I'll encourage you. And then he says, imitate one another and encourage one another. So it's the community, ultimately, who bears the care of souls for one another. It's what it's all about. And One of the things we note in Paul's and in the Hellenistic philosophers is there's a way to talk to people in their distress. Sometimes people need very gentle encouragement. Sometimes people need harsh speech to stop them in their path if they're doing something really destructive. So one of the things the philosophers talk about is appropriate speech when dealing with others and leading them along the moral path. So look now, in our few minutes left, let's look at this 1 Thessalonians readings. I grabbed these out of the lectionary. They're proper 24, 25, and 26 in year A, I think. And they are, 1 Thessalonians is often used as an example of Paul as a Hellenistic moralist. So he starts out just with his usual introductory words. He says, Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians. And so he thanks God for, and so forth. All of this is sort of formulaic letter stuff. All the way down through 1:5 is pretty much how you open a letter in the ancient world. Then finally I got it pointed the right direction. Then in 1:6 it says, this is where we get into the Hellenistic moralist stuff. And you became imitators of us and of the Lord. Okay, first one, imitate me first, then Jesus. Because Jesus isn't here with you right now. And I'm more flesh and blood human being. You're more likely to be able to get something out of imitating me. For in spite of persecution, you received the word with joy, inspired by the Holy Spirit. And so you became an example to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. So once they imitated Paul, they knew what they were supposed to do, and they could become models for other people to imitate. That's what that's about. They became psychagogues of these other churches. For the Lord, the word of the Lord has sounded forth from you not only in Macedonia and Achaia, but in every place your faith in God has become known, so that we have no need to speak of it. For the people of those regions report to us what kind of welcome we had among you and how you turned from God to God from idols to serve a living and true God. And to wait for his son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead. So these are all sort of teaching moments, reminding people what they already know. Then on 2:1, you yourselves know, brothers and sisters, that our coming to you was not in vain. He's reminding people of what they already know. That's part of the formula. But though we had already suffered and been shamefully treated in Philippi, as you know, we had courage in our God to declare to you the gospel of God in spite of great opposition. So that's the sufferings of the philosopher which distinguish him from a false philosopher. Then in 2:3, for our appeal does not spring from deceit. I didn't lie to you, or impure motives or trickery. Okay, impure motives or trickery are about false philosophers who try to get people to give them money, basically. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the message of the gospel, even so we speak not to please mortals. It's not about my fame and glory, but to please God who tests our hearts. As you know, and as God is our witness, we never came with words of flattery or with pretext for greed. I wasn't trying to get money out of you people. I didn't try to just butter you up. I told you the truth. That's what he's saying. Nor do we seek praise from mortals, whether from you or from others. Though we might have made demands as apostles of Christ, I could have asked you for money, but I didn't. But we were gentle among you, like a nurse tenderly caring for her children. That's the interesting phrase. Anybody notice anything funny about that verse? Well, there's a variant reading. The earlier reading most of us used were, there are different texts in the New Testament. The earlier reading that people often used was, we came among you as infants. And then it says, like a nurse caring for her own children. People read it like that for a lot of years. Then they decided the better text to read was one that our reading reflects. We came to you, we were gentle among you. Apioi is the variant reading that they've accepted now. Napioi meant infants. Apioi means gentle. So they think that the scribe that had the Napioi one just made a mistake and that it should have been gentle. We came gentle among you like a nurse caring for her children. Think about the image of a nurse. He was somebody with a little tiny child gently taking care of him. That's what Paul's saying he does for his congregation. So deeply do we care for you that we have determined to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our own selves. It's our own soul we're sharing. That's about friendship. I become your friend. You remember our labor and toil, brothers and sisters. We worked night and day so that we might not burden any of you while we proclaim to you the gospel of God. Okay, Paul, we think, worked as a tent maker. Wasn't that what he was supposed to do? So he was self-supporting, and he did this on purpose so that he was trying to get money from him, because that was really important, that he have his own integrity. You remember our labor and toil, brothers and sisters. We worked night and day so that we might not burden any of you while we proclaim the gospel of God. So then later, on 2:11, it says, as you know, we dealt with one another, with each one of you, like a father with his children. There are two models of ministry. One is that of a nurse with her baby, and the second is a father with his children. Both are sort of gentle images, I hope. And he says, urging and encouraging you. That's what his letter is supposed to do. Encourage people in things they already know. Pleading that you lead a life worthy of God. Well, anyway, I just wanted you to see the little elements of philosopher's life that are apparent in that little reading from Thessalonians. And another reading you might want to look at is, you won't have to look at it because you hear it in weddings a lot. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in truth. And here's the list of virtues. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. So in different parts of Paul, you'll see lists of virtues and lists of vices. And sometimes they're sort of woven into the text. But what Paul also tries to do is what a philosopher would do, give people moral instruction on the right way to live. Decide what kind of qualities you want to have to practice. You want to practice gentleness, endurance, kindness, all of these things. Not for their own sake, but for the way they bind community together. So I don't know if we've gotten very far, but you ought to try to think of Paul as a philosopher, and you might get a different angle on him, because he's an interesting guy, really. And you might want to read the Tom Wolfe book, too. That's it. I'll recommend that. And Weight Watchers works, too. But it's largely ladies, I found out.
I think,
largely? Yeah, largely. I think men are too comfortable with their shape. I think that's the deal. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.